a poem by David White entitled "Everything is Waiting for You." Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone, as if life were a progressive and cunning crime with no witnesses to the tiny hidden transgressions. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings. Surely, even you at times have felt the grand array, the swelling presence, and the chorus crowding out your solo voice. You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you freedom. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. The stairs are your mentor of things to come. The doors have always been there to frighten you and invite you. And the tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to divinity. Put down the world of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. The cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything is waiting for you. So welcome everyone to the second talk in this series on the 10 Oxurating Pictures. The reason I read the poem, because one of the ways that we can envision the unfolding of this path or the finding of the ox is in terms of leaving our loneliness behind, of this sense of isolation and the sense of being remote to the world and being holding ourselves very distant from it is very much what we see in these oxurating pictures that we brought tonight. And let me just read the inscription under the first two, which was the first talk and the second. And I know they're small, but I hope that you'll make your way up here or back there, because there's another set back behind us, to look at them, because they're quite interesting and they have a whole Zen history that's quite fascinating as well. The first one, the search for the bull. And it's underneath it says, "In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull, following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distinct mountains. My strength failing and my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night." And that's really the sense of absolute aloneness, isn't it? Much like David White's poem, that we don't know how to perceive the world except from our isolation. And though the last sentence here is really the key, where he says, "I only hear the locusts chirping through the forests at night," which is the conversations of the world trying to get in. But because we keep perceiving them as distant and remote and distinct from us, we won't let them in. And so there's no way for our heart to be nourished by the world, because we have barricaded it through our own perceptions. And then the talk tonight, discovering the footprints of the ox. And underneath it reads, "Along the riverbank, under the trees, I discover the footprints. Even under the fragrant grass, I see his prints. Deep in remote mountains, they are found. These traces can no more be hidden than one's nose looking heavenward." And so once we are aligned to what a footprint is, to the call of our yearning, then everywhere we look, we see something that brings us into the fold of that yearning. And we see that everything has meaning, not in the way that we used to think about it, but in as a way to feel much more a part of, interconnected with. And so the movement from the search for the ox to the discovery of the footprints is really a resonance within ourselves that we are more than we have perceived ourselves to be. Right? Under that perception, have you ever felt that? I mean, many of us start in the most remote, isolated position that we possibly can. We think we're here and any sense of the sacred is to be found externally, and the Godhead is outside of ourselves. And we like that position because we can be enslaved within our obedience in that perception. We can just do what the good book tells us to do. We can just follow the dictates of the scriptures. We don't have to face ourselves. And obedience is much easier than self-knowledge. So many of us choose to keep it externalized because of the fear of what it would mean if we ever brought it internally. But it's only partially satisfying. I mean, to keep God distant from us is not good enough. To keep it objectified, to keep the world and the sacred objectified, doesn't satisfy. It satisfies our arrogance. It satisfies our righteousness. It satisfies our need to believe and our argumentative points, but it doesn't satisfy and assuage the heart's yearning. And so cautiously, we decide to move inward. Now this is a huge step, really, because no longer are we searching for the sounds of God externally. What we're beginning to feel that we, the sense of us, may contain the Godhead as well. That maybe the sacred is not outside of myself, but maybe I have to look inward to see whether there is an origin within me as well. So we turn uneasily to face ourselves. Up until this point, it's a little bit like, have you ever, for those of us who wear glasses, ever looked for your glasses while they're on your face? That's a little bit like searching for the sacred. It's because we're afraid, really. You know, when we're afraid, if we can bring a protector to guard us. And if you ever walked through some of these early cathedrals in Europe, 14th, 15th, early years, middle ages, where you walk into these cathedrals that have the walls are, it's cold inside, but the walls are many, many feet thick, and it's all built of stone and solidity. And you just get this feeling of building a statue to the highest glory, from a point of fear and from a meaningless me to something that is so majestic and so powerful and so expansive, from these cathedrals, you know, where they just reach up forever into the sky. You get a feeling for how that fear back then, the plagues and everything was unknown. So the only thing that we could possibly have to help us through this is an all-powerful God. And so there was so much energy was placed within that perception. But There's a maturity of vision that comes when there's some sophistication and understanding of what the world is and where diseases occur and what happens to us along the way, and sort of the science of it as well. We begin to sort of relax with the need to fear. It doesn't mean that the unexpected doesn't happen, but that we have a sense of how things work in the world. And I think with that greater sophistication comes a relaxing of the need to externalize our gods as all-powerful external beings. And so I think just in the maturing of the earth and the species along with it, we naturally come to want to address this inward itch that we haven't been able to scratch up until now. This sense that I'm taking myself to be too small on this planet. Simply stated, I'm undermining my own empowerment, my own sense of a being. And we feel it. It's the reason many of us are drawn to meditation is that meditation allows the grace of that to be seen. And in meditation, we may get sidetracked any number of times, but out of the corner of our eye, sometimes we can see something or feel something or intimate something larger than ourselves, like a quick-moving, animal as we look into a field. And I don't mean it literally in that way, but that something is felt within our meditation that gives us a sense that we are much richer than, and much more vast than the narrow way that we have defined ourselves. And this gives us an encouragement. This is the footprint of the ox. For many of us, it's the first footprint of the ox. Up until this time, we've just been using meditation, as the beginning class says, to help me settle my discomforts and allow me to bring some more enjoyment in my life, a little more quiet and peace, a little more rest and less anxiousness, which are all nice. It's home improvement, fender repair. But it does nothing to the motor of the car. But suddenly, we're caught off guard because we see this little movement out of the corner of our eye. And I don't, again, mean this literally, but we sense that, wait a second here, something more than just what I had planned on happening is occurring. And it takes perhaps some time before that movement occurs, that sense of distant jerkiness as that creature moves rapidly. But it's there, and that's the reason we bow to one another after. We don't bow to one another in our separation. We bow because we've each seen it, or we each know it's there from previous scenes, from previous sightings. And that's the reason we bow to the Buddha, because he represents to us the potential of what we could be if we could just step out of this confusion. And so the footprints of the ox become very important to how it is that we practice and what it is that we practice. We practice to access that feeling. But we keep falling out of grace, don't we? Our next meditation has no access to it at all. And we think, oh, wow, I've fallen from grace. I've been cast out of the garden. And then we practice in order to regain that footing. And we try very hard to come back into the garden. And we try to mimic all the conditions that occurred the last time we felt that little flinch that occurred. And our job is to keep it sustained, or we think our job is to sustain it and maintain it. And yet, no matter how hard we try, in fact, often, the harder we try, the more elusive is this feeling. Because As we're trying more and more diligently, we bring in ourselves to bear in our practice. Our practice becomes self-managed and self-maneuvered. And with that large sense of me bearing down within my practice, anything sacred is, if at all seen, it's back way behind the outskirts of the city. And so, just through almost trial and error, in the course of the sitting, in the course of our meditation history, we find how to work the levers of the meditation so that we can have a greater sense of this abiding wonder. That is, if we are accurately following the footsteps of the ox. The problem is that there's a companion to the ox called the egoic ox that seems to be following, and many teachers will be pointing the direction of the egoic ox, not knowing perhaps in themselves or deliberately misleading. I would like to think the former. And we get lost in the leadership of where we think we need to go rather than the actuality of the experience and the heart fulfillment that our meditation provides when we authentically move in accordance with the true footsteps. And unfortunately, for a long period of time, we come out of our meditation and we're forced to access the normal me. The normal me comes right back in. And the normal me, at this stage of the practice, is what we're trying to get out of. We're trying to flee from. We don't want the normal me. The normal me doesn't represent anything that's sacred at all. The sacred must be something far-reaching, far more, some transcendent me. And so the sense of me coming back in after meditation is almost a sense of failure. And this sense of lost and found and having and lacking is kind of the principle that's working during this phase of the spiritual search. We operate on this lost and found, having and lacking principle. And much of the drive within us, if we're honest, is that we try to find settings, like retreat settings or prolonged meditation periods or quiet forests or something, that we can access the special me, the me that has very refined concentration and states of mind and subtle, pervasive tranquility and ease and gentleness and all the things that we relish, that we want to have as the definition of me, we can sometimes attune to in special environments. But we come out of those special environments and suddenly we've lost them again. We're out of grace. We hear a simple instruction like be mindful. And we assume, okay, I'm going to be mindful all the time. And we set out, and just in thinking to be mindful all the time, we probably lost our way in the first moment we tried to be mindful. Don't worry. Have you ever tried that? You say, okay, now I'm going to really remember. And the next second, you've forgotten. So what's going on there, you see? What ox are we following? That's a better question, isn't it? What footprints are we following? And could it be that the real, genuine, authentic footprints are that obscured and that hard to find, that difficult to track? Is that possible that something so authentic? In any way we define that word, because at this phase we really don't know how we define that word. Some of us define it as those states and qualities of mind that hold their allurement. Some of us define it as just being aware, and having some awareness, and it somehow will drop into some kind of emptiness at some point, or we don't really know what we think. And we have our techniques, and we have our path, and we have our methods, and we're on the trail, and we feel really good about it, and suddenly we look down, and we're following our own footprints. We're not following the ox at all. And we can't figure this out. I was, when I first stepped out, sure enough, I can tell the difference between my size 10 and a hoof print. But suddenly, the hoof print has changed into my shoe size. And I'm just wandering around aimlessly. Is this first gentleman in the picture? And I think, wow, this isn't authentic anymore. I've lost my way. But it doesn't mean we aren't feeling a little bit of the results. We're feeling that some genuine benefits from the practice, no matter which prints we are following, to be honest. And people are beginning to notice us. Our family says, why don't you sit, Dad? You probably need some sitting. And points to the cushion when we have a lot of upset and anger. If your family hasn't done that yet. And so it's not that there aren't results. It's just what results are we following? And what are the meaning of those results? How are we translating this path? And are we translating it according to the following and the trapping of the ox? So these questions follow us well into these first couple of frames. And a meditation student, through their own diligence and perhaps following a correct instruction of the meditation, will begin to notice the difference between thinking while they're meditating and actually being present to something, with something that's occurring as an experience. And so there's a sense, oh, this very different world, two very different worlds I live in. One where I'm thinking about what it is that is happening to me as it is happening, and sometimes just thinking when things far away from the experience at hand. And then there's the experience of having actually my mind quiet a little bit and being rubbing up against it very intimately. So there's this preciousness of presence, being present. And it just kind of feels very human-created, me-created, because I've been working so diligently to try to just bring my attention to my breath, that it feels like the products of that have to do with the effort and striving that I'm giving it. And as soon as I release that effort, oh, my mind just goes to the abstract and conceptual world of thinking. I'm lost again in thought, and I have no relationship at all to this sense of presence. So I rightfully think that it's my muscle and my ambition that allows this to be seen. And one thing that I'm beginning to sense as I'm doing this is that there is a vastly different world between the world of direct contact and the world of thinking. And that's an important ox footprint. No matter how remote we are to what we conceive of as the end, this is definitely a footprint of the ox. To get a sense of what thinking does to our world view, to anything and everything experienced through thought, is vastly different than that which is lived from presence in direct contact with. And suddenly I'm getting a sense of what footprints I might have been following all along. The footprints of thought and my thinking my way into my spirituality feel very human-made by me. And I can't think that I would get very far just following my thinking around. But when I get quiet and I feel myself and feel a different dimension of myself come forth, and yes, I still think of it in terms of myself, at least there is something here besides just the isolation and lonely me I've known. And I have more and more access to this sense of another a dimension of myself through my hard work. And so we get keyed into this. The harder I work in our belief, the more this thing's going to have a payoff. In this awareness, this sensing of the awareness that may hold a real gateway to something that is genuinely of wonder. But we feel like the mindfulness, the awareness is from our effort. So we're following the footprints and we're beginning to see what is seems to be more authentic than thought. And so we've come a long way, no question. No question we've come a long way. And we also see that it doesn't make any sense just to let my mind float with thinking, that it needs some training. And we'll talk about that training as the pictures develop. But we'll try to stay on track here with just this finding the footprints, finding the tracks. And I began to see that the more I get reactive, the more I have this sort of inward difficulty with myself, that I lose all context of awareness. I lose all context of the ox tracks, the tracks of the ox. So I began to think that maybe knowing myself or becoming at ease with myself might be the tracks themselves. Maybe that I need to, instead of ridicule myself, belittle myself, which I have done my whole life, try to get over myself and through myself to find the sacred, that maybe I have to actually, because it seems that I'm interfering with everything I try. My mind gets in the way of everything. And my reactivity, my thinking, my emotional indulgence, my attitudes in the day, they seem to somehow keep me outside of this genuine and authentic path I'm leading. And so I think, well, what can I do? Like, I would love to be able to get over myself. But no matter how hard I try, I follow right along. And I'm bringing myself along in this. So I start with self-aversion, hating myself, being self-ridiculing. And as I enter the practice for the first time, I see all of the vanity and the arrogance that I have always lived with. And I say, no wonder I hate myself. I have good reason. Look at all this stuff in here. And so I try to push myself out of the picture, and it doesn't work. And finally, I realize that I have to understand myself, that I can't get dislodge this thing. So what is this thing that I'm trying to dislodge? And at this point, I still have a lot of self dislike, but I am resigned to the fact that I have to get to know it. Doesn't mean I like what I have to get to know. In fact, the more I get to know myself in these early stages, the less I like about myself, and the more mistrust I have of the world, because I see the hidden tendencies in me, and I know that they're also in you, and you're just not looking. And so I have contempt. Not only do I have hatred for myself, but I also have contempt for the world. It's a wonderful person to meet on the street. And at the same time, we have enormous idealism, because the ox will cure me, because we feel it inside. We have that genuine yearning. And we think, okay, you know, I just got to follow the ox with my own efforts. And as we begin to see, our own efforts brings ourselves forward. And when we bring ourselves forward, we lose the ox. So it becomes paradoxical. I want this thing, but I don't want me. And that idealism, I have had a number of cases where I have seen that idealism. And if somebody, when they first get involved in the practice, you can see the idealism coming, and you can almost, if you just rub beneath the skin, scratch beneath the skin, you can also see the self-hatred, which has led to the idealism. Those work hand in hand. And there was one woman who was very, very passionate about her meditation and how wonderful it was. And when everybody, as I mentioned before, is when anyone comes to me with that kind of state of just enthusiasm about meditation, you just begin to suspect how much dislike they must have that's driving that enthusiasm to get away from themselves. And this one woman, she was in a position at Northwest Dharma where she could be around a lot of the teachers and also trying to handle the scheduling. At that point, this was some 15 years ago or so here in the city, Northwest Dharma was doing a lot of scheduling for Cloud Mountain, and she rubbed up against a lot of the teachers, and she became very disenchanted with us as by seeing our human, ordinary side. And she'd been sitting not months, but a year or two. Far too young to be brought into that position. You could almost have predicted what was going to happen. And she became very disenchanted. She left the meditation. And I haven't seen her since, really. I mean, she's around here somewhere, but not in this room. And so that idealism can fall very quickly because you're up against the ordinary. And you're up against the very thing you don't like about the ordinary, which is yourself and your reactivity. And when you see that and you have invested so much in the sacred being outside of that ordinary, outside of what is called a human beingness, then failure is inevitable. Inevitable. We require 3 years of experience to be on our hospice board, or on our SIMS board. Because I strongly believe that if people come on before that and they see me in action, they'll not only leave the board, but they'll leave the Sangha. I want a sober and experienced person so that they can handle my human qualities, because believe me, I have them. So this sense that the ox is going to cure me is a phase and a wrong footprint. The ox isn't going to cure anyone from anything. It's a flight from our natural state of being. And we find that the more we try to fix our humanness, the more we hurt. And if we listen very carefully to where pain comes into our evolution, you'll see the footprints of the ox. As I mentioned, in searching, it's painful to search, and that's why we stop searching. And in this one, it's painful to idealize and to try to get over ourselves and to try to get away from ourselves. And at some point, what gets our attention is the pain of what we're doing to ourselves to try to get to purity, to try to get to the ox. And something finally registers that it shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't be becoming... just to give you an example, some people who do prolonged concentration retreats and therefore aren't in touch with their everyday mind, but are doing absorption retreats, concentration absorption retreats, where they're just looking for certain states of mind, they buffer up against the retreat I do in September, the Labor Day retreat. And so some of them stay and come into my Labor Day retreat. And they often tell me the story of how They come home and they're irritated and annoyed when anything goes wrong, and they just hate the noise all around them, and they can't stand how their wife or spouse or whoever is their little irritating movements. And I said, well, you've really spent a worthwhile month, haven't you? Becoming more and more irritated. Does something go off in your head that something's wrong here? Is this the way you think the spiritual path should unfold? That someday you'll come home from doing just that and everything will be blissful? Everything will be just ease and harmonious? If you're living in that kind of circuitry, it's just going to get worse. It's not going to get better. Something's wrong with our practice. And lo and behold, it may take a long time because we so love the enamored states of mind, because they give us some sense that we have within us the sacred, something special that I haven't seen in myself before, so it must be holy. And so I go after these states of mind to prove my own holiness against my own unworthiness, fleeing my own unworthiness. And sure enough, the ordinary comes back, but it comes back with vengeance, because we have been using the other to be aversive to those states of ordinariness, to get away from ourselves. And that pain wakes us up, or is supposed to wake us up. But we just think we haven't done enough of it. And so many of us stay within that tortured frame of reference for how many years, you tell me. So we got to wake up. With pain is the indicator here. I mean, I guess you just go back to the First Noble Truth. We're talking about the end of suffering, the end of that pain, the end of self-inflicted difficulty. And if you're causing self-inflicted difficulty in your meditation, you're not meditating in accordance to the Buddha's way. You're not following the ox tracks. You're following your own desires. So let us be sober in our assessment of what we're doing. Let us look very critically at our practice, and we need that critical eye, because we don't know which footprints we're following. Which footprints are we following? Our own, which says, yes, go towards those pleasurable states, or the ox, which says, look at the pain of following those pleasant states and what it's doing to your life. So much of this is learning what an authentic footprint looks like. We all become trappers. So at some point, you decide, well, I can't fix this thing. I can't fix it. I must have to accept it, because it's unfixable. Every time I try to fix it, I create more idealism in my idea of where I'm going to be when I fix it, and therefore create more pain in the here and now of what I am, because I'm not yet that ideal. And I say, okay, I can't do that. I can't do that. That's following my own footprints. So, well, maybe I have to love it. Radical notion. Maybe I have to appreciate what's here. And that's an authentic ox step. Suddenly we see the hoof print. And there's a huge turnaround here. Huge. The problem is that I have to stop trying to fix me, the problem of me. And then we try to do it without really getting to know ourselves by, well, loving kindness ourselves. You know, just every time I have a problem, I'll put a loving kindness verse to me. And maybe I'll start humming the loving kindness tune instead of having to face really what the difficulty is. Now, it doesn't mean that loving kindness is the natural tendency of this turnaround. But we also have to understand that we can't meet who we are with loving kindness and expect it to just melt away. We have to understand that the very essence of what we want to melt away has authentic goodness as well. Well, we're just throwing rocks at ourselves, called loving rocks. It still hurts like hell, but if they come from God, they must feel better, right? But at this stage in our journey, and at this stage, because we're not there, we're just walking this thing. At this stage, we're not really interested in insight. And we haven't quite developed the capacity for insight because it takes a while for our mind to steady sufficiently so that we can see what it is that we are even being, what it is that we're bringing to this moment. And we're still wanting more good feelings. We just are beginning to sober up to chasing those mindlessly at the expense of who we are. So there's wisdom that's being accrued here, it's just not complete. And we're beginning to see in the course of things, a thought is just a thought. An emotion is just an emotion. And a little more dispassionately. That it doesn't represent my entire state of being. And so, it's not that insight isn't occurring, it's just back there behind all our ideas of what we need for ourselves in order to be complete. And so much of the spiritual journey towards the authentic ox is dissipating those ideas, because whatever you think completion looks like, it doesn't. But it takes us a long time, because we keep one of the problems of this journey is that the ox keeps changing. We keep thinking it's one thing, and we look around, and the prints, it's first an ox, and then it's a rabbit, and then it's a snake. And I mean, it's metaphorically, it means that our ideas about what it means to be fulfilled keep evolving. Our understanding of what we're looking for authentically in ourselves and for ourselves keeps changing. But this revelation that, my God, I'm not the enemy, is in the sense of beginning to sense a self-appreciation, is tremendously important. And now, from that, from the sense of self-appreciation, even though I haven't really understood much about my mind, I can begin to relax. The pressure is off. The burden is off to become something dramatically different. And so I can relax. And then, lo and behold, you see, it all moves around relaxation, not around ambition. So once I relax, my observation becomes more acute. Observation follows relaxation. And what follows relaxation and observation is allowance. So now I'm opening up more to what is there. And now genuinely these are steps. These are genuine steps of the ox, of the trail of the ox. I often present this, the mind opening to the tracks of the ox, in a similar way as the stages of grief. And if I can just take a moment to express what I mean by that. The first stage of grief is denial. That it's, I deny that I'm responsible for this. And that I think all I need to do is to get over myself. And so this sense of self-denial runs rampant early on in the stages of our spiritual journey. And then there is, when we realize that we have to face ourselves, there's a lot of anger on what it is that we see and what we have become. And we are digging a pretty deep hole for ourselves until we realize how to work with these states of mind and states and attitudes and patterns of life in a more useful way. We really get stuck in this in this. And many people leave the spiritual journey very quickly when they are become aware of the depth of our selfishness. And so that leads to bargaining, where you say, you know, okay, I'll put in my time, but I better change. I don't want to continue to see the... So I'll be good. I'll go on retreats. I'll do what I need to, but, you know, I better not come out like I'm going in. And then there's despair when we see that we do. Because you know, the patterns are still there. Sometimes 15 or 20 years is not a short period of time to live with the same persistent pattern. And then the resolution, finally, for some of us, if we stay the course, and it's a very iffy stay, is acceptance. But I don't like the word acceptance, because it means that you can reject it again. If you're accepting it now, wait a little while and you reject it. I like the word surrender. I like the word to release all tension toward. And that is where we are definitely knowing the correct path to follow. Because surrender is the method, the footprint. It makes it obvious. It makes us expert trackers. Expert. And I'll have much more to say about that as the frames unfold. Now, remembering that the ox trail lurks with danger and intrigue, what good story wouldn't, right? You're not going to sit here and watch this guy come into the sun. You're going to watch him meet the ox and get all caught up in the briar patch of life, right? So, we have to be very careful that we are our worst enemies all along the way. And to have some humility to be able to accept the fact that we are obscuring the very ox we want to see. That nobody is keeping it from us. That through our desires and fears, we're making this journey as hard as it is. And no one on the outside is doing that to us. And when we sober to that fact and meet those obscurations with honesty, again, the tracks become even more clear. And we're getting to the point now, this honesty is so essential, this sincerity of heart is so essential to own ourselves, to be able to say, and I'll show you how difficult it is, because most of us have difficulty saying, yeah, I did that. Did you do that? I did that. When I was young, my mother would line us all up, and there were five kids, and she'd say, did you do that? Did you do that? No, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. I didn't. Occasionally, I would do it, but I didn't ever admit it. So the difficulty is the difficulty of owning ourselves. And you know how hard that is, right? To admit a fault, to say that we are weak, rather than, because it goes against our image. It goes against what we have built ourselves up to be. But when we're going against our image, and I don't mean as a contrarian, but in honesty, we are on the authentic path, and the ox hoof is right there. And that's what it takes. We can't pretend our way even one step forward. In fact, to pretend is taking two steps backward. Every time we follow our own footprint, we think it's leading forward, we're in reverse. It's being authentic, honest, or there's no path at all. And so the Sangha gets together and reinforces that honesty with one another. Because I'll be honest with you, you can be honest too. Yes, no, I have this pattern in me. I do this when this happens. It's just the state of affairs. But because we're also seeing a thought is just a thought, an emotion is just an emotion, a pattern is just a pattern, we don't get so out of sorts with ourselves when these patterns do arise. And with that, we can actually begin to critically look and discern what is happening when these patterns come forth. That's the authentic path. And I hope all of us are on that one. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? As we said, I just want to, there's something I wanted to mention about the talk, is that each one of these frames, these 10 ox herding pictures, they start out with a worldly definition of search. You know, searching is the sense of being lost and isolated and confused and all of that. But the sense of searching doesn't really end in us. It's transformed through wisdom, through understanding. And the searching later in the spiritual journey becomes questioning, wonderment. What is this? No longer forced or motivated by confusion, but by interest, by wonderment. What is this? Is very different than where am I? So the questions change from questions of confusions to questions of space and time and personhood. What? Who am I? What is this? That can be seen as a evolution of the searching. So the searching becomes the very way, the very method we use to extricate ourselves. And so each of these frames, like the footprint, what a footprint is, changes to who's making the footprint. Following the ox and the path and the traces and the tracks of the ox at one point becomes the very way we hold ourselves to the path. Another is, who is it or what is it that's creating the print to begin with? So each of these pictures, as I began to get to know them, turn back in on a more subtle way that actually propel the path rather than limit it. And so we'll talk about that aspect of the pictures as well. So if there are any questions or comments or discussion points, I'd be happy to try to entertain them. Yes. Her question has to do with aversion to yourself and herself, and when she starts looking and feeling the aversion that is there for all of us when we start looking, what do we do with it? How do we make it into the authentic path rather than to escaping to what's pleasant? And we can always find something in our body and mind that's pleasant that can take us away from that, usually thought. One of the reasons we spend so much time thinking in our practice is to escape the doldrums of what we perceive as there, boredom often, states of mind. The only thing that can be there are states of mind. So when we're fleeing off the thoughts, it's because we don't like what's being presented by our mind in that moment. So what is it? See, it's wisdom that brings us into the aversive. It's not force of will, It's not, I've got to do this thing. It's that you know that where we are entangled, where we are lost, is where we are most aversive, where we are pulling back and leaning away from something. We're creating its very nature in that leaning. We're creating the fear that we ascribe to the experience. We are creating it. We are the one that holds the fear, and we're inducting that experience with fear through our leaning away from it, through our not realizing the harmlessness of what that thing is. So when we get a sense of that, we're willing to face the experience and to prove it to be harmless by just not moving. I'm not going to move from this. And because all experiences are essentially harmless, as we begin to learn how to do that, it becomes a cultivated and direct way of seeing and using our meditation. So you don't pull back to try to find the pleasant states that might be occurring, but we look for the places where we feel entrapped, where there's resistance, where there's self-contraction around something, where we're having trouble with something, where we're making a problem out of something. That's what gets our interest, because we realize that our freedom depends upon the understanding of that particular relationship. Does that make sense? Yes.
I understand intellectually what you're saying about knowing when we're following our own path.
Yes.
And when we're following the real.
Yes. Yes.
But I somehow, I don't trust that I'm going to recognize.
No. Bless your heart. That's honesty. She says that she intellectually understands the idea that we could be either following our own footsteps or conversely following the ox footsteps, but she doesn't trust herself to know the difference, and rightly so. That's what my role is, for one thing, is to try to show us all along the way what's authentic and what's not. So that's a teacher's role, is to point those things out, and it's also the student's role to prove whatever the teacher is pointing out for him or herself, so that it doesn't become a dependent relationship on me pointing out your way to you. Once you understand or get a sense of the difference between those two, then you intuitively know when you're off the mark as time goes on. At first, it's important to, you know, all I do is tell somebody to get back and go left or go right, depending upon how they're leaning. And then when you get to know the strip in the middle of the road, and if you've seen it enough, you'll know your way, and you won't be dependent on me at all for that instruction. So it's helpful for some period of time, and it can get very subtle. It's not obvious for many of us for long, long periods in our practice. In fact, those kinds of things continue to arise. You go, oh my, well, all right, so there we are. But there are key points, and these key points, which I will be talking about in later talks in this series, there are key points to get familiar with. And the first key point is just knowing the limitation of thought. Is knowing that when you're thinking, you can pretty much mistrust what you're saying about whatever it is that you're pointing towards. It's your idea about it. It's not the fact. And skepticism. Thank you. A healthy skepticism. It's only going to get worse with age. To have a healthy skepticism about your projections, which are worldwide, and say, you know, yes, you're convinced in yourself that the evil lies in this person, And then you just wait a second here. You know, I don't know. I don't really know. To be honest means that you begin to challenge your own definitions. Also emotional definitions. Emotions are just as unwieldy and untrue in the sense of what reality really is as anything else. So that's the first, we begin to learn our way into this by seeing, as I mentioned, even on day one you begin to see and notice that what I say about something, including my breath, is so, it's worlds away from the actual experience of breath itself. If you can just take the simplest, I start the beginning class on day one with this exercise. I say, just all of you can follow, just feel the nature of your sitting on the floor or a chair. Just feel whether at that point of contact, whether that's soft or hard or smooth or rough or cold or hot, just the qualities of that experience. And now just take one of those qualities, let's say softness, and just form that as a word. Okay, and you were telling somebody about the nature of what your sitting was like. You would say, well, it was soft and rough or whatever and warm. And we would write letters to that effect or emails. But now, okay, so that's the word, but the word, now, so that's the word. Let's take the word soft. Now go to the experience of softness. Actually experience the definition, the immediate direct experience of what we just described as soft. You see, it's not even in the same, it's like not even in two different universes, isn't it? One draws forth from a file cabinet of memory, but is far away from any relationship with what is actually happening. And the second is the immediate acclaim of that experience. And so to say to somebody, yes, you know, this road is hard, this road is hard, you begin to realize that you're not really capturing anything close to what actually occurred. In fact, you're talking in different worlds. And you begin to spend more and more time with the direct experience and less time in the remote conceptual world. Because you find that everything you've wanted in life resides there. And everything you've wanted to be in life resides in the other world. And you are now faced with whether what you want to be as opposed to what you are. And that is the bifurcation. That is where the road splits. Many people say goodbye, I want to be, but I don't want, you know, I want to be what I want to be, but I don't want to reside with what I am. It's too awful, as I've been pointing out. This is to take a seat in what we are initially feels very terrible and sends us running. It's the first defense against self-knowledge, self-awareness, is what we have accumulated in terms of our patterns and emotions and everything. And so we're off there. That's why we have stayed so restless in our lives, is to stay away from that the true definition of what I am in terms of experience. I'd rather stay conceptually with the idea of my image. And that way I can have the email say the right things, even though I'm far away from the experience of that rightness. You get a sense? You see? So this is, all along the way, we're going to find very subtle ways in which this path divides on that central point, really. Okay.